From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Plants tell the story of a place, says field botanist and native plant nursery owner Jared Rosenbaum. If you want to be rooted on the earth you live on, you can look to plants to interpret that story. With his friend, a filmmaker named Jared Flesher, aka The Other Jared, Jared Rosenbaum creates what they call funky but highly cinematic 5-minute videos about the ecology of wild plants. The second season of their series, titled Rooted, is debuting on YouTube September 15th with a video on none other than the eastern prickly pear cactus, the only hardy cactus of the region. Jared the botanist is here today to tell us about it and about some other native plant stories, but first these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Jared Rosenbaum and his wife, Rachel Macko, provide design inspiration and plants to clients to make their landscape ideas come true at Wild Ridge Plants, their nursery in rural New Jersey, which is also a mail order source of distinctive natives. Jared's the author of the book Wild Plants Culture, and I welcome him again back to the program. I haven't talked to you in a while, and it's nice to hear your voice. How are you?
Thanks so much, Margaret. I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm good. I guess the last time we talked was probably about wild plant culture and about foraging and all kinds of other topics. And yeah, so all good. Praying for rain. You probably had lots of rain. I've had none.
We got a decent rain a couple of days ago, but it has been intermittently really droughty all year long.
So. Yeah. I always get a weather report from people around the country that I speak to at the beginning of the show. So I was glad to get the word from you of more videos of a second season of Rooted, of your series that you do. And I enjoyed the first four. I loved, your collaboration with The Other Jared, because it's like in each video, you tell us about some of the many mysteries, really, of each of the native plants you profile. And mysteries, I use that word because, as you point out in a number of them, it's not like we know for sure everything. I mean, I remember the one in season one about wild ginger. And maybe you can just quickly tell us that little anecdote, because it's like, how did it get after the glaciers sort of pushed all the plants back down to the Carolinas or whatever? How did wild ginger, which is only able to move a meter or whatever at a time, how did it get all the way back up into the Northeast again in 16,000 years since the glaciers are, you know, these mysteries? And it's so fantastic. I love that you explore them in these beautiful videos, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, we are looking at one wild plant species and using it as a way to talk about an entire habitat, and often an entire habitat through time. So with the wild ginger episode, we're looking at this little bit of exposed marble geology in an area of otherwise very different bedrock geology at a park in New Jersey. And just on this little seam of marble that used to be a quarry, there's a whole wall of wild ginger. So a little native herbaceous ground cover. And I did botanical surveys at that park. It's over 2,000 acres. Wild ginger wasn't found anywhere else but on this little seam of marble. So the question I ask myself when I see something like that is, how did this plant find this spot? What is the probability that in a sea of acidic gneiss and granite bedrock that somehow wild ginger would get to this little sliver of marble? And the additional weirdnesses are, wild ginger is dispersed by ants. So it's not like birds are flying it all over the place and pooping it out, and it has a chance to scatter across the landscape prolifically. It's dispersed, maybe a meter or two a year. And so, in the midst of thousands of acres of potentially geologically inhospitable habitat, because while ginger likes a calcium-rich bedrock, how did it find this space? But then there's this deeper time story too, which is that all of our native plants from northern Jersey on north were pushed down to refugia pretty far south of here during the last ice age, which geologically wasn't really that long ago. And how does something get back up that many hundreds, thousands of miles in 10,000 years or so if it's dispersed a meter per year? So we're weaving these stories both about the habitat as it is now, but also trying to access, like you said, I really like your wording, the mystery of this, trying to piece together clues. And ultimately, we don't really know the answer. So in the latest episode or the upcoming episode of Rooted, we talk about prickly pear cactus. And prickly pear cactus, Opuntia humifusa, is the only cactus that ranges this far up into the Northeast. And cacti are an almost entirely American group of plants. And the genus Opuntia is totally American and was thought to originate in South America and then sort of radiate up maybe through the Southwest and then over into the Southeast and then eventually figure out how to adapt to our conditions up here in the Northeast. And, that's taking place over thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. And meanwhile, I live in New Jersey. It's kind of ruralish, but it's New Jersey, let's face it. And it's a lot of forests and post-agricultural land, but there's this really cool spot. It's only about 10 minutes south of where I live, and it's a canyon in the Delaware River. So it's where the river has undercut through all this shale and conglomerate and created cliffs on both sides. And on the New Jersey side, the aspect of those cliffs is really southerly, southwestern. So it gets a ton of sun and it's really hot. And it's kind of the closest thing around here to going to Arizona. And sure enough, draping down those cliffs and on the lips and ledges of it is this prickly pear cactus that has somehow made this millennia-long journey and evolutionary journey from South America also here up to here, but also somehow made this journey to find these cliffs that are the closest thing we have to Arizona in, northern central New Jersey. So on the one hand, I'm telling a story about prickly pear cactus as I see it. It has these beautiful, super showy flowers. It's a sprawling cactus that kind of drapes down the ledges of the cliff. It has these specific adaptations to really arid, harsh habitats, like cacti have photosynthetic stems that function like leaves, and it doesn't really have leaves. And it has these big stems that store water. And it exchanges gases at night and photosynthesizes by day so that it's not, opening up its pores to potential desiccation in the hot sun of the environments where it lives. So cactus is like supremely adapted for exactly this spot. And we're weaving together a story of, all right, cactus is great for here. And how the heck did it get here in the first place? And just trying to assemble the clues. And in the process of it, we end up talking a lot about place. And so, in the introduction earlier, you talked about Rooted and how it's about exploring place. And to me, plants are the ultimate storytellers because by their presence or absence, they're able to tell us so much about the present, but also the recent history. Was this a farm? Was it pastured? Was it an old growth forest? Was it left? Was it a woodlot? Looking back hundreds of years, but also looking back across geological timescales, like that little sliver of marble that
How did that
turned
become
out.
a magnet for that plant? If it did or whatever, who knows? But this is what I love. And I love that in these, five-ish minute films, and they're beautiful, and there's even music, sometime, you know, at certain points, that you get us thinking about all these things you used earlier when you were describing the first one. In season one, we were talking, you were talking about refugia, these places, these refuges that plant populations were pushed to, in when the glaciers moved and receded, whatever. And there's these words, these beautiful words that evoke history and things that we don't know about. And again, mysteries, and I just think it's great. I mean, that's what I'm interested in too, I guess. So that's part of the reason I think it's great. But I don't even think we have in the upper Northeast. I don't know about if you in Jersey do. I think in Pennsylvania, maybe there might be a native sedum, like in terms of even succulents. I mean, sedum ternatum, I think, maybe goes up into Pennsylvania and maybe
A
even in New
little bit of
Jersey.
sedum ternatum.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's what I was thinking, is that would be about it, right? But I mean, let alone cactus. It's not like we're rampant with cactus. Yeah, not even other succulents that I can really think of too much. Can you? I mean,
There's not a lot of native succulents,
yeah,
so.
no. So it's really a this is quite a unique creature in much of its range, right? It's an odd duck, and because it's yeah. And what so what are the these are tough spots that you found it in. Do you propagate it and sell it at the nursery and so forth as well? Is it a plant that
Do
you
grow
offer?
prickly pear cactus, and I have to tell you that baby prickly pear cacti are like the cutest plants. They're these tiny, tiny little fuzzy barrels, and they're absolutely adorable. And if you just let a prickly pear cactus fruit decompose and eventually have all the seeds that were grouped together germinate at once, you have like this little barrel of kittens. Like they're fuzzy and they're so cute. But even just the individual little cacti, they come up as tiny, 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 tiny little miniature cacti, and they're completely adorable. So yeah, we do grow and sell them, and part of the joy of it is the propagation process with that plant is really cool.
And what do people think when they come to the nursery and there's the cactus? I mean, do you have, I mean, I would think it would, well, maybe your customers are more savvy about native plants and they know this already. But, if I saw it in a regular garden center, I would maybe be surprised.
I think sometimes people see it and they want to know where to put it because it's not a tall plant. It's not a plant that you can put your Joe Pye weed and your big native grasses and hope to have it persist. It needs these places that are so harsh that those taller, or maybe we can say more aggressive species can't cut it there. So it kind of needs to be either hanging off a ledge of a cliff, or the other place where we have it quite common in New Jersey is along the dunes along the Jersey shore. And I know it extends further north along the shore as well. And just in these sort of infertile sands with very little competition. And you mentioned refugia earlier, and I'd like to connect the dots on that and say that sometimes these really harsh habitats are places where you'll find really unique expressions of plant diversity. One, because unusual plants grow there, but also because they're refugia in the sense that, nobody ever took these cliffs and made a cornfield out of them. Nobody grazed their, cattle up and down them because they were completely inaccessible. And the same thing can sometimes be said for, the dunes or other harsh habitats. So when we go to, and something I often think about is, think about like how diverse could a native meadow be if it was around for like hundreds and hundreds of years? But I don't know any native meadows around me that are probably even 100 years old. They all used to be farm fields or whatever, and then sometimes people have maintained them as meadows rather than converting them into something else. But I wonder, like, how diverse could a native meadow be? Because of course I'm looking west, I'm looking out to the prairie or what remains of it, and how absolutely gorgeous and beautiful and also old growth it is. We think of old growth in the context of trees, but old growth can also pertain to a prairie with its wildflowers and grasses and so on. And so as I'm looking for sunny communities that have been persistent for a really long time, the places that I keep finding myself gravitating towards are cliffs and bluffs and glacially scoured ridgelines and other glades. So places where trees are not as dominant as they are in deeper, more fertile soils, and they allow for community of sun-loving, but not necessarily very big or aggressive plants to grow. So a lot of small plants like cacti or smaller wildflowers that, because of the harsh pressures of the environment, are diminutive. And of course, they're wonderful to look at. They're super cute. They're often very showy, and they're the kind of plants that I, at least, am drawn towards gardening with also. And place like the cliffs over the Delaware, I can go there and think it's quite possible that these cacti have been here for thousands of years and the other species around them. And there's some really cool other plants existing there with the cactus. So there's alum root, which is sort of a Heuchera americana, like our native coral bells. There's wild columbine. There's moss phlox growing native up on the cliffs there. There's one of our native sunflowers, Helianthus divaricatus, the woodland sunflower. There's this whole assemblage of plants that you're not necessarily going to see deep in a thick, shady woods, but you're not necessarily going to see in like a meadow that sprang up from a farm field either. It's its unique community, and it's almost the thing I can liken it most to. It's like our eastern version of a really special prairie. And
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing is taking inspiration from the natural plant communities as we look to combine plants and understand what plants want if we're going to cultivate them outside of their native environments, is to look and really try to glean some of these insights like you are and saying, well, what's going on here and why are they here and what are the conditions and who are they with and why are they here? Not with the big guys that would shade them out or overrun them. And you know what I mean? You're drawing these inferences that can help us also to utilize them in the right way in the right places. You were saying, you're drawn to some of the unusual and the small things. And you on I think it was on Instagram the other day, you mentioned that also at the nursery you have some. You cultivate, at least you had a small amount of a hemiparasitic plant for sale. Speaking of oddball things, Pedicularis canadensis. I don't even know if it has a, I guess it has a, what is it, something betony or something? What's
Now
in,
it's either called Canadian wood betony or lousewort, and like who comes up with
lousewort.
we're trying to popularize these plants, but they're called golden ragwort and lousewort, and it's kind of horrible. But yeah, pedicularis is this cool, also really diminutive plant with these super cool flowers that are a little bit like elephant's heads, and they're really colorful, and it gets some of its sustenance from the roots of other plants around it. And as a possible upshot, by reducing the vigor of maybe some of the more aggressive plants around it, it's able to enhance the diversity of its immediate surroundings. It's kind of creating a level playing field. It's like, oh, there's these really powerful actors here, and then there's these smaller plants. And by kind of like tamping down the really powerful ones, maybe there can be more diversity in the spot. And I will say that that is, supported in some scientific literature and not in others. So we're still trying to figure out why pedicularis is in really cool spots. And it may, it's sort of a chicken and the egg thing. It might be like, well, it's there because this is a really interesting, diverse habitat. But
I see it up at my neighbor's about a mile straight uphill from me, my next door neighbor, and they have an incredible hundreds and hundreds of acres of very special conserved land, and I see it there. And that was where I first met it years ago, and and so it was fun for me to see you speak about it, tell its story. and wonder about it. And again, speaking of mysteries, right? Because we don't know for sure. Does it in fact sap some of the energy from the otherwise more thuggish, more energetic plants, and thereby make room for some of these little guys? We don't know, but that's one. It's one theory, and yeah, and it's very interesting. What are the things that are, I mean, on the other end of the spectrum, what are the things that are most popular at the nursery? What are the sort of, or do people come to you for the oddballs?
I'd like to think that people need both the basic building blocks,
mm-hmm.
you know, to be really successful and want to go deeper and find those oddball plants. And that sometimes the oddball plants, they're oddballs because they fit a really specific type of place. So there's your generalists, like your, you know, again, with the Joe Pye weed, and swamp milkweed is really great at that, and New England,
uh-huh.
all that kind of stuff. And then as you maybe become more immersed in the place where you're gardening, you'll realize that it can support certain kinds of plants that are more specialized. So maybe you have a really moist clay soil, has high nutrients to it, a lot of organic matter, and holds water after rain. And, you know, all of a sudden you start gravitating towards plants that are found in marshes, swamps, and wetlands. Or you have a really bony, gravelly soil with hardly any organic matter over it, and you realize that you can grow all these cool subshrubs and maybe even our native cactus. And I think that in exploring the natural places around us and getting a more rich sense of what's there, we then can sort of translate that back to where we are and where we're gardening. And I have to say that as much as I love all these little plants of glades, all these kind of dwarf plants, like, you know, your wild pinks and even like your low bush blueberries or New Jersey tea or what have you, got a pretty fertile soil here. And they just fail to thrive. Now I want to create that beautiful cliff face or bedrock exposed ridge line here, but it just wasn't working because give it a couple years and it'll be full of goldenrods and asters and so on. And what we ended up doing was, you know, I heard your podcast about gravel gardens.
Yeah.
I made a gravel garden here out of gravel from dolomitic limestone. And now all those little plants are completely thriving in there.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
All those little dwarf diminutive special plants. And so that's how I was able to make the translation. You know, I'm just taking inspiration from these almost prairie-like openings up on the top of a, you know, rocky hillside or what have you, but then bringing it back to the gravel garden here. And I love how those plants are now thriving in like the harshest spot that I made. So harsh that there's not a lot of weeds.
Yeah. So in the last like 4 or 5 minutes, 4 minutes or so, I wanted to talk about season two again. So you're starting out with the opuntia, the prickly pear, the native eastern prickly pear. And then there's 4 installments in the series, what, one a month or something like that. And what else are you going to feature this time?
So we just finished filming Beach Plum down at the New Jersey shore. And, you know, in and among the dunes. And beech plum is this incredibly hardy and apparently really low shrub. But part of what beech plum puts up with on a daily basis is it's being buried by the shifting sands of the environment that it lives in. Sometimes you'll see what looks like a foot tall or 2 foot tall shrub, but it's actually has a trunk going down, you know, several to many feet more. So when we plant beech plum here, they're like 6, 8 feet tall, but down along the dunes there, they're just kind of buried, and they're so tough. You know, there's salt spray, there's just the heat of the sand, there's how dry it is, and there's the fact that the substrate they're growing on is always moving around. And so, you know, we're kind of using beach plum to talk about barrier islands and to talk about the impermanence of shore habitats, and also to talk about how important those dune systems are to sheltering what's further inland, because they're right at the interface between the sort of fury of the sea and the beginning of the mainland.
So that's another one. And you're doing, I think, are you doing purple milkweed maybe?
Yeah, we got purple milkweed. Purple milkweed growing along a power line a little bit south of here, and talking about, again, sort of open habitats. And the last one that we're doing that we're going to go finish filming tomorrow is pawpaw. So you asked earlier, what do people come to the nursery for a lot? And one of the things that people find really fascinating are these delicious native fruits and things that they've never tried before. And so, beech plum has always been popular. Pawpaw always sells out. And pawpaw is another weird creature. It's another southerly species from a largely tropical group of plants that has somehow figured out how to thrive, as far north as Canada. And so it looks tropical and it tastes tropical. It doesn't look like something you would associate with New Jersey, but here it is. And the spot where we're going to is this really like kind of gnarly post-industrial area right south of Trenton. So it's living on the edge there, and it's a really cool spot.
Interesting. I didn't know. That does sound like an unusual location for it. So, speaking of plants that have found unusual homes, yeah, that's great. Well, I would love to do a book giveaway with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. Let's do a book giveaway of your wild plant culture
Great.
Book as well, because I know that's popular, and I had fun with it when I read it when it first came out. So I'll do that as well with the transcript. And I'm always glad to speak to you, and congratulations on doing another series of these videos. I'll give all the links. We'll embed some with the transcript of the show too, a couple of the older videos, just so that people can get a flavor of it. Because as I said, I just think they take you on a journey, these stories that you tell so well, you and the other Jared tell so well. So thank you so much for making time today, Jared.
Thanks for delving into it with me, Margaret. I really appreciate it.
I'll talk to you soon again, I hope. And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show. And you can find me anytime on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.